You know that game we used to play a lot? What is Janet Yellen thinking? Yeah, today, we just asked her. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, the 9th of November. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We do have a change of venue on the program today, as you might have heard, because when the Treasury Department calls and says, hey, you want to talk to the secretary? Well, you start checking flight schedules. That is about as much throat clearing as I'm going to do, because there was a whole lot of stuff I wanted to ask Secretary Yellen when we sat down earlier this afternoon. I want to appeal to you as a labor economist.
Okay.
From days gone by. And I want to talk about not the hard infrastructure program that passed the other day, but the President's Build Back Better program. And here's what I want to know from you. Again, not as Treasury Secretary, per se, but as a woman who studied this for a long time. Does the economy need the Build Back Better program, or do the people in the economy need it? Because the economy is doing pretty well right now.
Well, I think the economy needs it and the people need it. Not because there's a shortage of jobs. So it's not a short-run stimulus program. It is really intended to address long-standing problems that have been holding this economy back. And let me be a little more specific.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
It helps families afford childcare. Right now, a typical family with childcare pays about 13% of their income to finance childcare. This bill will limit the amount that most Americans have to pay to 7% of their income. This will help Americans, particularly women, work. It'll boost labor force participation and growth. And it will provide better resources for children growing up. And, of course, climate change, it provides tremendous resources to address what is an existential threat globally and in the United States.
You say this is not a short-run stimulus program, and I wonder if that's the basis for your belief that this will not be inflationary in this economy, because, as you know, inflation's a big deal right now.
Well, inflation has been running at higher levels than we've been accustomed to seeing for a long time. And I know that really imposes a burden on households.
On those families you were just talking about trying to help, right? The ones on the lower end of the spectrum.
Well, yes. But I think you should see it as a consequence of recovery from a very severe shock due to the pandemic and something that will work itself out over time. But over the medium term, this is anti-inflationary. It's easing expenses for families, taking some of their most important and worrisome expenses, like childcare, like health care. And in that sense, too, it's relieving the stresses from inflation that we're seeing as our economy is opening back up.
Can you help people, I guess, understand why you and Chair Powell, but I've got you in front of the microphone, why you believe the inflation that we're seeing now is transitory, that by the end of next year, it's not going to be around. Why do you believe that? Because you look around now, it's not great.
Yeah. Well, you know, what happened when the pandemic struck, first of all, there's been a dramatic shift in spending away from services toward goods. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, led to reductions in some countries in the ability to produce goods. So the consequence is that goods prices, which had been falling for many decades, suddenly have increased substantially. We're seeing port delays as ships that are full of these products are finding it difficult to find warehouse spaces to unload and to hold those goods.
That's the why, right? Sorry to interrupt.
Important.
That's the why, right? It's incredibly important, and I grant you that. But I want you to explain why you believe by the second half of next year this is all going to be worked through, because it doesn't. How do you know? Is the question, I guess.
Well, I I believe that as vaccinations are increasing and we can see that the incidence of COVID has declined off its peak. So as the pandemic recedes in importance, people feel safe going back to work. You know, also a part of the inflation is that firms are finding it hard to find workers. And I think that's largely due to health concerns, issues with childcare. And as people feel safer, they'll go back to work. So expect to see more labor supply, and they're going to go back to services in a more normal pattern. And at that point, I'd expect the price increases to level off, and we'll go back to inflation that's close to the 2% we consider normal.
Okay, last question on inflation, then I'll get out of your hair on that one. What if you're wrong?
Well, it's something to be watched carefully. And I know the Federal Reserve is doing that if this turns out to be something that's endemic. In the 1970s, we saw supply shocks turn themselves into endemic inflation. We're not seeing that now. I don't believe we will. But if that were the case, the Federal Reserve would have a role to play to keep it under control.
I just want to be clear on that. Since you brought it up, there's a lot of chatter in inflation circles about, ooh, the 1970s, and it was terrible, and we can't go back there. You don't see that happening?
No, and I don't see it happening.
Okay.
That happened in the 1970s because people thought that policymakers wouldn't bring it to an end. And inflation expectations became embedded in the American psyche. That isn't happening now, and the Federal Reserve wouldn't permit that to happen.
I lied. One more inflation question, because you brought it up. Inflation expectations, why are they so important?
Well, they're important because inflation can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. As wages go up and firms see their costs go up and raise prices, we get into what's called a wage price spiral that just continues unless a central bank comes in and puts that to a halt.
More from the Treasury Secretary later on in the program, the debt limit, Congress, and the politics of her new job. On Wall Street today, hey, you remember yesterday when I said from now on that markets were only going to go up? Yeah, never mind. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are few American companies that have had more of an impact on this economy and on the way business was once upon a time done in this economy than General Electric. From Thomas Edison's light bulb to appliances and television networks to jet engines, GE was everywhere, including, as a founding sponsor, having its jingle written into the theme song of a certain public radio program on business and the economy. The economy doesn't work the way it used to, though, and so today GE announced its long but recently troubled run is kind of over. It's going to split itself into three separate publicly traded companies, one each for aviation, healthcare, and energy. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher breaks down the breakup.
For 129 years, GE has been poking its entrepreneurial fingers into a number of industries: locomotives, energy, appliance, aerospace, plastics. And for a while, diversification worked. In the early 2000s, GE had a market value of more than $500 billion, says John Joseph, professor of strategy at UC Irvine.
It was one of the most valuable companies on the planet at that time.
But then GE made some moves that did not pan out. It invested in financial services. Then came the financial crisis.
GE was not spared.
Peter McNally at Third Bridge says GE's investments in things like aircraft leasing and industrial and medical financing backfired.
The company was really hobbled by the financial crisis with a lot of debt. And it's taken a long time to sort out the mess that the company had become.
GE has been sorting out that mess for years now, trying to pay down debt and focus its business. And now Nick Heyman at William Blair says splitting into three will make each of the baby GEs more agile.
You cannot basically hook all the horses up to the stagecoach and hope to be able to respond as quickly as you could with one horse pulling one wagon.
GE is not the only corporate behemoth to go this route. Hewlett-Packard did it, and so did IBM and Siemens. UC Irvine's John Joseph says it's a trend because smaller companies have more flexibility.
They can kind of pursue their own destiny.
And then there's the stock market. If, say, GE's aviation stock sinks, its healthcare and energy companies can say, meh, that's not about me. Joseph says that's why many investors like corporate breakups, too. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
This past summer was one of the hottest on record. Climactically, yes, of course, but also for teenage jobs. With an economy well on its way out of the pandemic and a labor market where if you want a job, you can get a job, we are at the lowest levels of teenage unemployment since the 1950s. The teen job market is so tight, in fact, that lawmakers in Ohio and Wisconsin have proposed rolling back some of the limits on the hours younger teens can work during the school year. And whether you think that's a good idea or not, it's a fair question to ask whether this pandemic could be a turning point in reversing decades of declining teen employment. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Alonzo Solis owns several tropical smoothie cafes in Cedar Park, Texas, and says along with bananas and kale, teenagers are an essential ingredient in his business.
You know, honestly, without them, we'd have to close our doors.
Like many restaurant owners, he's had a tough time staffing up, even after raising wages to $15 an hour plus tips. So more than two-thirds of his workers are high schoolers, putting in 10 to 20 hours a week.
We're very flexible with their schedules. You know, they're balancing school, they're balancing extracurricular activities.
20 years ago, about half of teenagers worked. That rate has dropped steadily since to about a third of teenagers. Luke Pardue is an economist with payroll platform Gusto.
What we're likely seeing right now is a turning point in the way that teenagers see themselves fitting into the labor market.
The share of teens working has dropped a bit since the summer, but Pardue says there are signs that wasn't just a blip. According to Gusto data, teens are already being hired for the holidays at double the rate of 2019.
Teenagers have entered the labor force at a higher rate, and those higher rates are likely to persist for years to come, just as teenagers rethink whether they can work during school.
But the trend isn't necessarily positive if it hurts teens' academics, says Lauren Bauer with the Brookings Institution. College enrollments dropped in 2021, just as the labor market heated up and more teens took jobs.
Losing that investment in themselves at a very pivotal moment in their lives is going to have potentially long-term consequences.
Because while wages at a smoothie bar seem great for a high school kid, jobs that don't require some college generally pay a lot less in the long term. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Unfortunately, it's a repeating story.
Go ahead. Take a guess. What can it hurt? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 112 today, 0.3%, closed at 36,319. The NASDAQ dropped 95 points, about 0.6%, 15,886. The S&P 500 slid 16, about 0.3%. 46.85. General Electric, Amanda Peacher was telling us about that, up 2.6% today. The video game company Roblox jumped more than 42% on much better than expected third quarter results. Thank you very much. Revenue grew 102% year over year.
To the big screen now. AMC dimmed 11.3%, even though the movie chain posted a smaller loss than analysts had predicted. The company's CEO said further challenges lay ahead because of COVID-19. Once again, this is me, not that CEO. The virus is in charge of this economy. Concerns about the pandemic and rising gas prices are making a lot of Americans hesitant to travel over the holidays. That's according to the president of the American Hotel and Lodging Association. New survey from that group, commissioned by the data intelligence company, Morning Consult, indicates just 29% of Americans are likely to travel for Thanksgiving. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Inflation and supply chains and the people in this economy aren't the only thing Secretary Yellen's got on her mind, you know. In a bit more than 3 weeks, we are going to bump up against the debt limit again. So that was topic two I wanted to ask her about.
Okay, enough about Janet Yellen, labor economist, Janet Yellen, Treasury Secretary. I want to talk about the debt limit. You have been outspoken, as have all Treasury Secretaries since the debt limit became a thing, about how catastrophic it would be. How confident are you that Congress is going to do the right thing?
Congress is always, in the end, done the right thing, although sometimes they wait a long time to do what they wait till the last minute. In 2011, the debt ceiling was raised, but Congress waited so long to do it that the United States suffered a downgrade. I believe Congress will do it, because to not pay our bills would be catastrophic for Americans. Interest rates would rise if we were to fail to make payments that are due on the debt. We would see people, 50 million Americans who receive Social Security wouldn't know when their next check is coming. Similarly, for American troops, tax credit payments that come monthly would be held up. This is something that would harm all Americans, would result in likely a recession.
You're a political animal now, so, and I apologize for that insult, I guess, but so I feel okay asking you this question. Why do you think this Congress will do the right thing? Have you met this Congress?
Well, I have, and I believe that it's understood that it would be catastrophic. We simply must pay our bills, and I think members of Congress understand that. In the end, they'll find a way. I believe it should be done on a bipartisan basis.
But if not, you're okay with the Democrats just doing it? I guess you got
to
be, right?
I believe I want it to be done. I believe that both Republicans and Democrats should do it. It's a kind of housekeeping chore. It's not covering new spending. It's necessary because of commitments that both Democrats and Republicans have made in the past. It's like running up a credit card bill and then saying that you're reluctant to pay that bill. It's simply a must. American Treasury securities are the safest asset in the world, and it would be utterly catastrophic and irresponsible to endanger that.
One more little bit from the Secretary of the Treasury in just a couple of minutes. Stick around. Been a little bit more than 2 months since what had been Hurricane Ida dumped record rain on New York City, 3 to 5 inches an hour, says the National Weather Service, which flooded streets and the subway and basements, including more than 1,000 basement apartments. At least 45 people were killed in the New York area, more than a dozen of them when those basement apartments flooded. Others lost everything they had. And it's exactly this kind of flooding that's going to overwhelm our infrastructure as the planet gets hotter. And people who live in those places are going to need some help. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on that one.
Just before 9:30 p.m. on the night of September 1st, the National Weather Service issued a flash flood emergency for New York City for the first time ever. At the time, Alejandro and his partner Diana, whose last names were withholding because they're undocumented, were at home in their basement apartment in Brooklyn.
It was really pouring, and the water started coming from the windows and from inside of the walls, also through the bathroom to the apartment.
Within about half an hour,
I was flooded, completely flooded.
We went outside and we stayed at the car for the rest of the night.
The next morning, when they went back inside, everything was soaked. Their furniture, their clothes, the floors, the walls. They had to throw almost everything away.
I feel so sad, honestly, because, you know, I didn't expect nothing like that here. It was bad for me.
It was bad for a lot of people living in basement apartments in Brooklyn and Queens. Many of them were low income and many were immigrants.
Unfortunately, it's a repeating story.
Carlos Martin is at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies.
We see the most vulnerable people. This includes low-income people, people of color, and people with a mixed immigration status living in precarious housing that is more likely to be damaged by these disasters.
That's because it's often the only housing they can afford, particularly in expensive cities like New York. And he says the problem is only going to get worse.
Not only because the affordable housing crisis is getting worse, but the climate crisis is getting worse.
In New York, a lot of low-income immigrant families end up living in illegal basement apartments that are increasingly vulnerable to flooding.
And so they're paying extremely low rents, but they take on the risk of living in an apartment or building that is not meant for really people to live in. And these tenants have nowhere else to go.
Lena Lee at the tenant legal services organization Communities Resist says many of them can't get federal disaster aid from FEMA either because they're undocumented.
And so the families that were most affected were completely locked out of any access to any of these resources.
To remedy that, New York State and City created a $27 million relief fund a few weeks after the storm for people who aren't eligible for FEMA assistance to help replace furniture, do home repairs, and even move. Each household is eligible for up to $72,000. On a recent Tuesday, Alejandro and Diana brought their application to an office of the Chinese American Planning Council, the community-based organization that's been designated to help people in Brooklyn apply for the fund. They'd gathered their lease, all sorts of receipts, and photos of the damage. Two months after the storm, they're still living in their apartment with just an air mattress and a table.
I'm scared of the mold. I'm scared of the water because every time it's raining, I have to expect the water in the house.
Now they're hoping that maybe they'll get enough relief money to be able to move out of the basement.
And buy, let's say, a bed, a proper bed, a table, you know, basic stuff. That's it.
And start over. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the last thing I had on my list of questions for Secretary Yellen.
Very last thing, and then I promise I'll let you go. I'm not going to waste the question on what you think about the renomination or new nomination of a Fed chair. But since you used to have that job, and I'm not sure I've heard anybody ask you this question, which do you like better, being Treasury Secretary or running the Fed?
They're both terrific and
oh,
important.
Oh, you are a political animal.
They're both terrific and important jobs. I very much enjoyed being Fed chair and all the jobs I had at the Fed. Fed has a critically important set of responsibilities, and so does the Treasury Secretary. I think the infrastructure bill, I think the Build Back Better package and the recovery plan, which was enacted shortly after President Biden was elected, they're all tremendously important to the well-being of America and the American economy. It's a privilege to be able to participate in fiscal policy.
All right, we're out of here. I figure like 8 or 10 minutes with the Secretary of the Treasury is enough of a moment of economic context for you, right? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Jenna Nguyen, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.